From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. For several years now, there's been this belief that the thing that makes a young person successful is her cognitive ability. It's intelligence, the skills you can measure in a test. According to the theory, the best way to develop this skill is to practice, and you begin as early as possible. This is where the baby flashcard phenomenon came from. Well, in his latest book, the journalist Paul Tough says there's a growing group of people, economists, educators, scientists, who've been doing research that calls into question this idea. The book explores a new way of thinking about child development, one that focuses on character and how it's developed and nurtured. Really, it's about this question: how do our experiences in childhood make us the adults we become? Join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The journalist Paul Tough is joining us today to explain why some children succeed and why others fail in the education system. For several years now, there's been this belief that the thing that makes a young person successful is her cognitive ability, her intelligence. But Tough has found that really the qualities that matter most are about character, about things like persistence and curiosity and self-control. His book explores the science that's helping understand how character works and is developed in young people. In the book, he explains that these character strengths don't appear to us magically as a result of good luck or good genes. In fact, he says they're rooted in brain chemistry and that they're molded by the environment in ways that actually are measurable and predictable. Today in the program, Paul Tough is joining us to talk about his book. It's called How Children Succeed: Grit, Curiosity, and the Hidden Power of Character. Paul Tough is the author of a number of different books. His writing has appeared in the New York Times Magazine and The New Yorker. He's been a longtime contributor to the public radio program This American Life. He's joining us today from a studio in Boston, Massachusetts. And Paul Tough, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
I want to start with the story that you tell in the introduction to the book. It's the summer of 2009. Your son, Ellington, had just been born a few weeks before all of this, and you were in this pre-kindergarten classroom in this small town in New Jersey. And you write about how, as the day was progressing, that you started to notice that what was happening was kind of unusual. Talk about that moment, that story.
So the classroom that I was in is one of about 1,000 classrooms across the country that are experimenting with this new curriculum for pre-K and kindergarten students called Tools of the Mind. And Tools of the Mind, the idea is that the skills that are most important for kids, especially in those early childhood stages, are not necessarily cognitive skills. That the most important skill is self-regulation. So it's a two-year program to try to teach self-regulation, and they do it with some very unusual techniques. You know, when you are trying to teach cognitive skills, usually the methods are pretty predictable. You just keep drilling kids in the same tasks, and they do get better at those skills. But with self-regulation, you know, you can't do self-regulation drills. So instead, Tools of the Mind teaches it through a variety of methods, including play. A lot of what they do is what they call mature dramatic play, long extended scenarios, make-believe scenarios. And the idea is that in the process of doing that, kids learn to regulate themselves because they have to play a role. They have to follow rules.
What was the thing that you found so... Because you're talking about the context of all of this, of course, is that you yourself, a new parent, and you have all this anxiety about how you're going to raise your son and how you're going to educate him. And that's what's going through your mind as you're seeing all of this. So what was striking about that?
Well, I think for any parent, especially any new parent, you're in a bit of a panic state.
Yeah.
And a lot of, you know, as I was thinking down the road to a lifetime of parenthood, I was thinking about, you know, what qualities do I want to try to help my son develop in order to help him succeed? And so Tools of the Mind was really, a lot of what they're doing is really a paradigm shift. And a lot of the other things that I explored in the book that I eventually went on to investigate, I think are part of the same paradigm shift. They're really challenging that idea that what is most important is cognitive skill. And so that made me sort of challenge some of the assumptions that I felt were in the culture and in me personally, in terms of what Ellington should be doing. I think I I sort of went into parenthood feeling like I think a lot of anxious parents do, that I had to, you know, break out the Baby Einstein DVDs and the flashcards pretty much in the maternity ward in order to set him on the course to, you know, the right college. But what Tools of the Mind and lots of this other research pushed me toward was this feeling that, first of all, that I didn't have to be quite as anxious, but that it wasn't as much of a race as I thought,
yeah.
And that there were other skills that were a lot more important to try to help him develop.
You write about what is compelling about this idea of cognitive development. You know, you talk about how it's linear, it's neat and clean.
Right.
And I guess that's what's been so appealing about it is, look, you just, you know, you get the right flashcards, you get the right DVDs, and it's going to work. There it is. There's a solution. And it doesn't, it means you can, you can, poverty doesn't necessarily matter. All that matters is that cognitive skill. And that's, I guess, what's so appealing about the idea in the first place.
Yeah. I mean, I should say, just as a caveat, like, intelligence does matter. So,
right.
I mean, part of why it's appealing is that, you know, it's true to a certain extent. Like,
sure.
Having better test scores does help kids, and it certainly can help kids in poverty. But I think we also, we overemphasized it, and I think the reason that we've overemphasized it is that it just does seem to have this very clear solution to problems. The experiment, to me, where this was most evident was this study that I actually wrote about in my first book and then wrote about again in this book about language in the home that these two child psychologists named Hart and Risley did starting back in the 1960s. And they went into the homes of families from different classes, and they tried to figure out what was going on in these homes that was affecting kids so much, that they were having such different academic results when they entered childhood. And they concluded that the big difference was language. They actually counted the number of words that the kids heard in the home. And they concluded that kids who were the kids whose parents were on welfare would hear 10 million words by the time they were three, and the kids whose parents were professionals would hear 30 million words. And they figured that was what the thing that made the difference. And so that really unleashed a lot of child interventions over the last couple of decades that were just about trying to expose kids to more language. And, you know, again, language does matter. It's certainly helpful for brain development to hear a lot of words. But I think there was something about those nice, neat, round numbers, 10 million and 30 million, that made us think, like, that's just the answer. If you just ramp up the number of words, that's going to change everything for these children. And really, I think what was going on in those homes, and the more that we continue to peer into these homes and really investigate what's going on in childhood, the more complicated the picture gets.
One of the things you write about is how there's really a lot of research being done on this question, you know, challenging this concept, but it's so spread out. And what you found is, I guess it seems, is that people aren't really communicating with each other about these new findings that they're discovering.
Yeah, they're starting to. I mean, it was in for a journalist, it's kind of an exciting sort of sweet spot to hit where you feel like they're starting to talk, so they would connect me with one another, the economists with the neuroscientists with the psychologists. But at the same time, I felt like I was, you know, sometimes ahead of them, not in the research itself, but in making the connections. I could be sort of like, hey, wait, do you know what this economist is doing? What his research is a lot like yours, even though you're in a completely different field. And I think the way academia and research works is, you know, neuroscientists talk to neuroscientists and economists talk to economists. And there are some people now who are trying to push through that because they really realize that if you really want to understand what's going on in you know, the way economists think about childhood, they need to know more about psychology and vice versa.
I wanted to ask you about, there probably wasn't one eureka moment where this started to occur to people, but you do write about, James Heckman is one of the people you write about who's really sort of challenging this idea. He did some really interesting studies that were examining all of this, and it seems like he's the one that, or one of the first ones anyway, to start talking about the fact that maybe this was less about cognitive development, or at least it was more about psychological traits. Talk about him, if you would.
Sure. So James Heckman is a Nobel Prize-winning economist at the University of Chicago. And he is, I think, if there's one person who's sort of tying together these different fields of research, it's him. He started to hold these conferences where it's economists and psychologists sitting down together and trying to find a common language to talk about how children develop and how they develop skills. And so, you know, finding his research was sort of a eureka moment for me. And for him, I think the eureka moment came with his study of the GED.
Yeah.
And this was more than 10 years ago that he first started looking into the GED. And the GED, just to summarize it briefly, is the premise behind it is that what gets taught in high school is cognitive skill. That really, you know, what matters in for a high school graduate is how much they know, how smart they are. And so if you can take a test, if you're a high school student, you hate high school, and you can take a test showing that you have the same cognitive skill as a high school graduate, then you are a high school graduate. You know, you get all the same, you get a piece of paper that says you can go to college, you can do all the things that a high school graduate can do. So Heckman went and looked at some big databases of children and adolescents moving into adulthood and tried to test out this hypothesis and see, well, so what does a GED really represent? Mm-hmm. And he found that in lots of ways the thesis behind the GED is absolutely valid, that the kids who did have a GED were every bit as smart in terms of their IQ scores as the kids who had a high school diploma. But he also found that in terms of their more significant outcomes, their educational attainment, and their salary as adults, their even things like how likely they were to be arrested, they didn't look anything like high school graduates. And in fact, they looked exactly like high school dropouts. Yeah. Their life trajectories were very different. And so this was a huge challenge for you know, an economist, because economists tend to think that cognitive skill is the thing that matters, and that, you know, they believe in the GED. They think that it's true, that if you can have something that measures these cognitive skills, it's going to predict success. And so that started pushing him to try to figure out, well, what is this thing that's missing? What is it that the high school graduates have that the GED kids do not? And so for a while he called this dark matter, because he couldn't figure out exactly what it was. But eventually he came to believe that this dark matter was what economists now call non-cognitive skills. That has parallels in neuroscience with this group of skills called executive functions.
Yeah.
And in education, it has parallels with what some teachers call character strengths. Figuring out that there was this very specific set of skills, basically the, you know, what those high school graduates had was the ability to get through high school, you know,
yeah,
the ability
right.
to delay gratification, to put up with a boring task, to figure out what the teacher wanted and to do it, to get up in the morning and, you know, show up at school, and that is really what a high school diploma signifies, but that those are actually really valuable skills in terms of how you do in life.
Mm. We'll get more into the particulars of character as we go, but maybe we should define what you mean by that, because there is a difference you talked about between, you know, moral character and yeah. what has been called performance character.
Yeah. So the definitions of these terms is a big challenge in the book. It's a challenge I kind of like, but,
yeah.
you know, none of these terms are quite right. You know,
right.
non-cognitive skills turns out to not quite be the right term, because actually a lot of these skills have a big cognitive element.
Yeah.
But character, I think, is a great word, and it's actually the term that I use the most in the book to represent these skills. But I think it's a problematic one as well, because it means to a lot of people, yeah, values and mm-hmm. ethics and being, you know, nice and polite and things like that. And while these researchers think all those things are important, what they're really focused on are the skills that make people effective, that make people successful. I think the other thing that's true about how we think about character is that we tend to think that it is something set in stone, you know, that you're just a good kid or a bad kid, you're this sort of person or you're that sort of person. And the way that these researchers and educators are defining character is as a set of very malleable traits, things that can be, that people can change in themselves, young people can certainly change in themselves, and that both teachers and parents can absolutely influence in the kids that they're raising or working with.
Mm. There's another insight that that you write about that comes to – there are two other characters I want to draw into the conversation now, Nadine mm-hmm. Burke-Harris and Elizabeth Dozier.
Yeah.
Nadine is raised in privilege in Palo Alto. She's the daughter of educated professional Jamaican immigrants. Elizabeth Dozier is born outside of Chicago, raised by a single mother. They come from sort of different kinds of backgrounds, but you talk about how they really sort of came up with the same kind of goal. They really want to help young people in trouble. You met them separately, but really they both, you talk about, were kind of at this turning point in their lives and in careers. And in the book, you say you were really drawn to their deep sense of frustration. To talk about them, because I want to explain their insights, what they've learned.
Sure. So, yeah, I found them both to be really compelling characters. Nadine Burke-Harris is a pediatrician running her own clinic in a low-income neighborhood in San Francisco. And Elizabeth Dozier is a high school principal in Chicago, working in a very high-poverty, high-need school called Fenger High School on the south side of Chicago. And I was interested in them for lots of reasons, but as I was sort of spending time with them and flying back and forth between San Francisco and Chicago, I did realize that they were at this very similar turning point where the sort of traditional tools of their professions, you know, the public health checklist for Nadine and the sort of tools of the modern principal for Liz Dozier, were insufficient. You know, the kids that they were dealing with were facing such huge obstacles, and that they were obstacles that you know were not just about physical health and were not just about cognitive ability. They went much deeper. A lot of the kids that they were dealing with had very chaotic, very troubled home lives, had a lot of trauma early on in their lives. And those things were affecting them clearly in terms of both their physical health for Nadine and in terms of how well they were doing in school.
Yeah.
And so both of them started thinking, you know, there's something missing in what I'm trying to do. That I need different tools.
You write about Elizabeth Dozier, how, you know, she arrives at Fenger and she has this, you know, this idea that I've got all the tools now that an educational reformer needs. And
right.
She comes to the school and she kind of cleans house, gets rid of what she thinks are bad administrators or bad teachers. But then this thing happens not far from the school. This young 16-year-old kid is killed.
Yeah.
And it gives her another insight that it's not about the staff and it's not about the fact that the school is neglected or ignored. I mean, you pointed out it's not. It has funding. And so she's thinking it's got to be about something else then. And what she realizes is, as you say in the book, that you've got to take into account what's happening in a community of a place.
Right. I mean, one of the things that I like about Liz Dozier and what's important to me about her story is, you know, I feel like we have these sort of two paradigms, the two sides of the education reform debate that we just kind of swing back and forth between when we talk about schools. And the so-called pro-reform side says, you know, if we could just get rid of the lousy teachers, we'd be fine. And the other side says, you know, if we could just get enough money into these and attention on these low-income schools, we'd be fine. And the reality is Fenger has both of those things. You know, she was able to get rid of all the teachers who were there and hire a whole new crew. And Fenger, the city is spending a lot of money at Fenger, but it wasn't making a big difference in the lives of these kids. And she came to understand it. Yes, I think the killing of that boy, Darian Albert, sort of focused the mind. And there's a lot of, I mean, he was the highest profile death, but even in the year that I was following her school, which was a year after Darian Albert, there were several more deaths. The violence in that neighborhood is really horrific. Mm. She felt like this was the important stuff, that what was going on in their homes, what was going on in their community was having such a huge effect on these kids that trying to intervene in the classroom alone, while very important, was just not enough. And so she started looking for other tools, other solutions to help her.
So there are these two things that are converging. You have now this sort of social concern from Elizabeth Dozier, and then you have Nadine Burke-Harris, who starts seeing these social issues kind of in a, well, she says that they can be understood on a molecular level, that she's
right.
Now thinking of this other strain, which is that this is about human biology.
Right. And so what I like about Nadine's story, she is a... I think she feels like she's a real sort of scholar at the same time as she's a doctor. So she started with this real just sense of frustration. She didn't know what to do. She'd graduated from like the Harvard School of Public Health, and so she felt like, I know exactly what I'm supposed to do, and felt like it wasn't working. And then learned about this one study called the ACEs study for adverse childhood experience. Which a couple of researchers did actually almost 15 years ago, where they found that the effect that having a traumatic childhood had on later health outcomes was really very powerful. She read this study kind of randomly, was someone at her clinic gave it to her, and it set her on this path where she just had to find out everything about these pretty obscure medical fields, about how stress affects the body, how stress hormones and brain development interact. And so she's now got these four binders full of medical research papers on her shelf. And I haven't read all of those binders, but I read some of them. And the science is really convincing to me as well, that what is going on for the kids in her clinic is that in the early, throughout their whole childhoods, but especially in the first couple of years of life, the stress that they are under is having an incredibly toxic effect on their brain development, and that is having not just mental effects, but also physical effects. Right. So you can trace the way that those the shocks to the system early on in a child show up in terms of health outcomes when people are in their 50s and 60s.
What I like about the book is that you illustrate this with some of the characters that you've talked to. Talk about Monisha Sullivan, if you would, because this is where she comes into the story.
Yeah, so Monisha Sullivan, when I met her, was 18, and she had been a patient of Dr. Burke Harris's for a couple of years at that point. And she had had a really rough childhood. Her mom abandoned her in the hospital. She was raised by her father. Both of her parents were involved in drugs, and when she was 10, she and her brother were taken away from her father by Child Family Services, and she went into foster care and spent the next 8 years of her life separated from her brother and from her father in foster care. And she was not a fan of the foster care system, and she sort of bounced around from one home to another, and there were problems everywhere that she went. So she'd had, you know, what we think of as social problems, as kind of classic problems of poverty. But, you know, Nadine, since I was talking to Nadine, it pushed me in the direction of seeing her problems through the lens of this biology. And one of the great things about Monisha is she is very articulate and expressive and explicit about how this stuff has affected her. And she talks about it in terms of its effect on her mental health. She is fearful and anxious and depressed. She has, she wakes up in the middle of the night worried that a bomb's going to go off or a plane's going to fall in her house. It's had physical effects on her. You know, her hands shake. She was losing her hair, and it had lots of effects, unsurprisingly, on her ability to succeed in school. I think this is true for lots of kids, and the science is there, but there was something about having this conversation with Monisha. She was just able to, because she was so expressive about it, she was able to make that cause and effect really vivid for me.
There's this... there's this system that I wanted you to at least mention, because I know it sounds probably really complicated for people, but I think it's important to understand when you're talking about sort of the biological dynamic of all of this. Can you say something about the HPA axis? I know it's really complicated, but it seems such an important part about all of this.
Absolutely. So the HPA axis is basically like our stress thermometer.
Yeah.
And it is, it's a part of the brain that is getting increasing attention in the last few years. You know, we tend to like think about stress as just, oh yeah, I'm so stressed out, you know, I had a stressful day, just this kind of, you know, it doesn't seem like this hugely vital part of how children develop and how health outcomes are determined. But the science in this field, in this field of neuroendocrinology, is moving ahead really quickly. And what these scientists are finding is that when kids grow up surrounded by intense stress, toxic stress, chronic stress early on, it really does a number on their HPA axis. Your HPA axis forms in those first couple of years of life. And if it doesn't have, if you're dealing with that sort of toxic stress, it doesn't know how to deal with it. And so the things that it's supposed to do throughout your life, help you deal with fearful situations, help you control your impulses, help you react appropriately to scary or tense situations. Kids who grow up with a lot of toxic stress have much more difficulty doing that.
Yeah. Harder time concentrating, sitting still, following directions. All the stuff you need at school.
Exactly. And so, you know, in it's in a school setting, I think, where, having a working, it's good to be stressed out sometimes, right? Like when your HPA axis is working well, it means that, like, when you're under stress, you get a little more, like, energy and tension. So, like, to me, when I think of, like, a kid getting a math test, you know, a kid with a well-functioning HPA axis, when they get that math test, they're, like, their heartbeat goes up a little bit, and they can concentrate a little bit more, and they're a little bit nervous, and that helps. You know, it helps them, like, focus on that test and get a good grade. If you're a child who has experienced a lot of trauma in your early years and you have a dysfunctional HPA axis, you know, you get that math test and it's like you're being attacked by a bear. You know, you just are completely freaked out. You don't know how to put it in the right context. You don't know how to react. And it makes you want to throw your math test across the room and storm out of school. And so even these little, you know, quite regular stresses that kids face in life, if they've had these sort of traumatic experiences early on, they don't have the biological system to help them deal with it later on.
Yeah. There's something you say in the book that I wanted to ask you about. You confess that you said from time to time you found yourself kind of wrestling with the question of guilt and blame. You know, how much of the bad behavior that you were seeing in some of these young people you were meeting and talking to, how much of that was their fault? Talk about that instinct or that sense, anyway, that you felt that you were trying to figure out.
Yeah. So I met this one student at Venger High School who Elizabeth Dozier had actually kicked out of Venger High School. a young boy named Mush.
Yeah.
Well, it wasn't too young. He was a teenager. I think he was 17 when I met him. Mush was enrolled in this mentoring program called YAP for Youth Advocate Programs, and he was getting a certain amount of help, and he was, I think, in lots of ways turning his life in a more positive direction. But he had done some, you know, genuinely bad things. So when I first started reporting on YAP, I didn't meet Mush for a while because he was in boot camp, and he was in boot camp because he had carjacked, stuck someone up and stolen their car. When I heard about his childhood, you know, he saw his uncle shot and killed in front of him when he was 8. His brother had been shot and killed when he was 14, and he just had an incredibly stressful and painful life. And you know, with everything that I'd learned from Nadine Burke-Harris, I could see how that was having a terrible effect on his ability to control his impulses and make good decisions. But at the same time, I feel like, you know, carjacking was illegal.
Yeah, yeah.
It's illegal for a good reason.
Yeah.
And so I feel like that was the line that I was trying to walk, to sort of understand what was going on with these kids and try to understand, you know, what sorts of interventions, or especially early on, could help them make better decisions. But at the same time, not just to say, well, anyone who's growing up in this kind of adversity gets a free pass, you know.
Right, right.
And I think that the way that The thing that made that make more sense to me was finding that there were lots of kids, you know, like Monisha and like some of the other kids in this YAP program, who were growing up in equally stressful and traumatic situations, who were doing the right thing, you know, who were still having lots of problems and not, you know, still had pretty chaotic lives and made mistakes sometimes, but still had enough of an inner compass that they could, you know, tell the difference between right and wrong and not break the law and make some really good decisions. So to me, I just tried to get on the page the fact that this I felt this found this was confusing. You know, I feel like we in a kind of political dichotomy, we want to cling to one of those arguments or the other, either like, you know, these rotten kids, or these poor kids, you know, who are just victims of everything. And I think, you know, as with all of us, it's more complicated. We've got some free will, but we're also very much affected by our environment. And trying to find the right balance between those things, I think, is tricky, but really important.
Paul Tuff is with us. His book is called How Children Succeed: Grit, Curiosity, and the Hidden Power of Character. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with the journalist Paul Tuff. We're talking about his book. It's called How Children Succeed: Grit, Curiosity, and the Hidden Power of Character. I wanted to ask you about, because you write about the effects and the importance of just, you know, really good parenting, you know, parents who create nurturing relationships. And you talk about how the effects of all of that, it's more than just emotional. You talk about how it's biochemical, and there's this really interesting test, this study that was done by a researcher at McGill, Michael Meany, I think is his name.
That's right.
He does this study with rats that really gives you a sense of how, affection, touching, nurturing has an effect on our DNA and the structure of our brains.
You're right. So this was another aha moment for me finding his research. I think it's really important, even though it is at this point mostly with rats. but I think there are real parallels in some other research that connect to humans. So I'll just say a little bit about his experiment. This started about 10 years ago when he and his colleagues had a whole bunch of rats in their lab, as lots of neuroscientists do, and they were in little family units, mothers and their babies called pups. And what they noticed was that there were certain mother rats who, when the pups were stressed out, which usually meant when they were handled by a lab technician and then put back in the cage, certain mother rats would do this one distinctive behavior called licking and grooming, and others would not. And so they decided they wanted to find out just exactly what licking and grooming did. And so they divided the mother rats into two categories: high licking and grooming rats, who they called high LG, and the low licking and grooming rats. And they had the pups stay with their mothers for the first couple of weeks of life, and then they separated them, had them grow to adulthood, which is, for rats, is about 3 months.
Yeah.
And then they gave them a whole battery of tests. And there was a huge difference between how well the high LG rats did, the ones who had received a lot of licking and grooming as babies, and how well the low LG rats did. The high LG rats were more confident, they were braver, they were more curious, they were healthier, they lived longer. And you could actually see in the development of their brain, literally the size and the shape of certain parts of their brains, you could see the difference between these two, and all because of this one pretty small idiosyncratic behavior that their mothers did just in the first week or two of life. And so Meany, over the last 10 years, has been trying to show that there are parallels in human behavior. For me, I think the research that's most closely connected is the research around attachment.
Right. I guess that's our version of licking and grooming, sort of.
Yeah. And it's not, I mean, I feel like when we talk about attachment, sometimes we think about a sort of like super attachment, you know, those parents who are like connecting with their babies 24 hours a day. But the attachment research that I find most compelling is not about that kind of attachment. It's just about sort of everyday good parenting, just being, just licking and grooming, you know, being attuned to your child's needs and responding to their cues. And I think the biggest parallel to licking and grooming is that it's really about helping out in moments of stress and adversity. And, you know, moments of adversity for most infants are not super, you know, great amounts of adversity. It's like wanting to be fed or picked up or, you know, burped. But being attuned to that child's need, responding to it, giving your child that message that you're there, you're paying attention, you're responding to all of their needs, is incredibly powerful. Certainly psychologically, but I think neurochemically, and obviously, you know, in some ways, the neurological process and the psychological process are just two ways of describing the same thing. And some of the attachment research that that I read, this one long-term study that was done in Minnesota, found these incredible parallels between the way that mothers behaved, again, just in the first year of life, first couple of months of their baby's lives, and how well that child did on the first day of kindergarten, how they acted in summer camp when they were in middle school, and even whether they would graduate from high school or drop out. So to me, there's some real parallels between those two sets of research.
You write about, it's almost like there's a formula in some ways. You know, you talk about how the most reliable way to really produce an adult who's, you know, brave and curious and kind, as you say, is just make sure they have make sure his hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis functions well, which, you know, you start with licking and grooming, as you said. But then you say, then they need rules and limits.
Yeah.
And more than anything, you say they need some child-size adversity.
Mm-hmm.
So talk about that, because there's a moment when you kind of have to switch from the nurturing and loving part to, you know, the independence and challenge part.
Absolutely. So I do feel like we have some pretty strong evidence that what a one-year-old needs from his or her parent is someone who comes every time he cries and responds to all of his needs. But I think we also know that, 10-year-olds and definitely 15-year-olds do not need a parent who comes every time they cry and responds to every one of their needs. And in fact, at that stage, it's quite damaging to a child, because what they really need is some opportunity to prove themselves, to fall and, you know, pick themselves up. And in fact, I think it starts a lot earlier than that. So my son is now just turned 3 this past summer, and I feel like my wife and I are really at that transition moment. And I'm sure we're going to feel like we're at that transition moment, you know, the rest of our lives, constantly trying to figure out how much we should lick and groom and how much we should stand back. But I definitely have felt it more just over the last little while, as what he really wants from me now, even if he doesn't always say so, is some room, you know, some ability to prove that he can do it all by himself. And so I feel like this is, for me anyway, as a parent, this is much more challenging stuff, because, you know, to me, the licking and grooming came pretty naturally. Yeah. It felt great to be the one, you know, to hug and comfort and care for my son when he was an infant. Now, you know, it's when he falls down, I try not to pick him up, try and let him pick himself up. You know, when he's another boy is not sharing his toys with my son, and he comes to me and wants me to solve the problem, you know, I'm trying to say, figure it out for yourself. It's tough, but I really do believe that is, on a deeper level, what he wants, and I definitely believe it's what he needs, and certainly what he will need more and more as he gets older.
Well, a good part of the book, you spend talking a little bit about the importance of failure. I mean, you write about your own experience, and what's so interesting is this idea of overprotecting your kids from failure. You talk about it's the thing that teachers and parents are most worried about. You know, that you're insulating kids from adversity, and there's something really striking that you write about. You say that the result of all of this, you know, kind of keeping our kids from, you know, getting up and dealing with adversity, is that we have fewer entrepreneurs who are graduating from good schools, particularly fewer artists, fewer iconoclasts, you say, fewer everything, you write, except fewer investment bankers and management consultants. Talk about that, if you would.
Sure. So, I mean, one thing I want to say to preface that is that I ended up in this book, you know, spending a lot of time in low-income neighborhoods like the ones we've been talking about, but also spending some time at private schools among really affluent families and really affluent kids. And so what I felt like is that we really have in this country an adversity gap. And I really came to believe in the importance of adversity and failure as a teaching opportunity for kids. But I do feel like it's important to emphasize that, you know, like Manisha Sullivan's problem was not that she didn't have enough adversity. She had too much adversity.
Right.
And I think that's what's complicated in terms of trying to figure out how to come to a solution for this for different types of kids. But I think the reality is that, you know, kids need a little adversity, but not a lot of adversity. And so someone like Manisha Sullivan, she's not getting stronger each time, you know, she moved from one foster home to another and encountered new adversity. She was getting weaker. It was really just doing her in. But I think there are many other kids who have an almost opposite experience to what Monisha had, and they just don't have enough adversity in their lives. And the research that's out there on character suggests, you know, something I think we kind of know in a common sense way, that to get these character strengths, you know, like grit and self-control, a lot of that comes from failure and comes from the experience of overcoming failure, of gaining the confidence of learning that you can overcome failure on your own.
There's this thing you write about. There was this law professor and blogger who had written, you know, the question was that why were so many college graduates going into investment banking? And this guy, James Quack,
yeah.
I guess it is, he made this point that it wasn't about money. They weren't doing it for the money necessarily. It was because it was the firms were offering them these jobs, which represented kind of, I guess, what the path of least resistance in some way.
Right. Yeah, I found that blog post totally fascinating. So you know, one thing that I just felt reporting at these independent schools, these private schools, was that I think that the parents and the teachers were both feeling like these kids just, you know, were under enormous amounts of pressure. They work really hard. They've got a ton of homework. They're super scheduled, but they never really face challenges. Like, the rules are very clear. There's not a real sense of risk anywhere along this, you know, very intensive academic path that they follow. And so they often go to fantastic colleges and get a fantastic education, but then they, as they approach their senior year, they still have never really been challenged. And what this guy, James Kwok, was making the point that, like, you know, and when you look at a school like Princeton, the numbers are pretty amazing. Like, a few years ago, it was 3/4 of Princeton graduates were going to investment banking and management consulting. Now, with, you know, the fact that almost the entire financial sector collapsed for a few years, it's down to a half, but it's still a half of all the graduates who are doing that. And, you know, the money's part of it, definitely. Those jobs pay well. But what, as you said, what James Kwok is arguing is that really it's the next step on that kind of meritocratic treadmill. That, again, it's like, it's very tough being an investment banker. It's very tough being a management consultant. But it's not surprising. It's not challenging. The rules are very clear. And even the rules of the interview process are very clear. You know, you have to go through certain steps, and it feels for those young people very much like applying to college felt, and it feels very much like making it through senior year of high school felt. And now here's another process that they can go through where again, working really hard, getting a lot of rewards, but not being challenged. And I think that what I heard from people who are growing up in that world and whose kids are growing up in that world is that sometimes it's not until, you know, their 20s or their 30s where kids who go through that process are suddenly feeling, you know, lost, like they don't know what they're doing or how they got there or what they should be doing, because they've never really had that experience of being challenged, facing up to failure, experiencing failure, and overcoming it.
What is there a difference between the you know, what you've learned and how it translates to particular reforms, particular changes? Is there a difference between, I guess this, it seems obvious in some ways, but maybe you could talk about what the difference might be between how you deal with an educational system in an inner city, say, that has its particular challenges, and one in, not even in an affluent area, maybe say a more sort of upper middle class suburban kind of area. Are the techniques that different?
I mean, I think at root, what kids need is a way to have sort of manageable adversity, experience it, and learn to overcome it. So I do feel like all kids need the same thing, but I think that the reforms that their different schools need in some ways are the opposite, because right now their lives are so different, especially in this spectrum of how much adversity they face. And so I feel like kids who are growing up on the south side of Chicago and going to schools like Fenger, they need protection from the adversity that surrounds them. And while their schools can be an important part of that protective matrix, it's not enough. They need help in ways that go far beyond the classroom. And so the interventions and the government programs that I feel like would be the right solution for those neighborhoods are about integrating academic solutions with solutions that involve child and family services and pediatric care and mental health services and family services of all kinds. And that what will work best for kids like Manisha and Mush is a system that is comprehensive and integrated and that really looks at their family situation as a very real problem and tries to address that stuff. It's going to be a complicated thing to solve, but I feel like right now the problem is that we haven't even got to the stage where we've said this is the real problem in these kids' lives, and this is something that we, as the public, have a responsibility to try to solve, and that this is something that we can solve. So that's the next conversation that I hope happens in those communities. And then I feel like in those upper middle class suburbs or those private schools, I feel like what's going on is that there isn't enough adversity, and there is this high pressure, high stress, highly competitive system that is not actually challenging kids. And so I feel like that's a different kind of reform. And I feel like actually a lot of parents and teachers, and certainly kids in those communities, are looking for those sorts of reforms. I feel like it's a bit of a standoff sometimes. Like I've sometimes gone and talked to parents and teachers at some of those schools, and I feel like the parents are all saying, the teachers just keep pushing our kids so hard, and the teachers are saying, the parents are pushing us so hard. We're all in this kind of treadmill. And I feel like no one can quite figure out how to be the first one to step off it. But I feel like as this research becomes more clear that it is not actually helping these kids, that it's not really giving them the skills that they need to succeed, which after all is the whole point of this intensive high achievement system, I think that change is going to start happening.
Paul Tough is with us. His book is How Children Succeed, Grit, Curiosity, and the Hidden Power of Character. We need to take another quick break and some final thoughts when we get back. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we've been talking with Paul Tough. We're talking about his book. It's called How Children Succeed, Grit, Curiosity, and the Hidden Power of Character. And Paul Tough, I wanted to ask you, you talk about in the book how when advocates who make the case for this new way of thinking, when they talk about it, they often base it in economics. They say, look, it's going to help save money and it's going to help improve the economy. What you say is a perfectly legitimate, powerful argument, but you say the thing that works for you most or resonates with you most is the personal one. Say something about that finally, if you would.
Sure. So, I mean, I spend a lot of time in different low-income communities, and a lot of the time that I spent was with kids who were overcoming all kinds of adversity. It made me feel a couple of things. I mean, one was that these kids alone I just felt proud of them. I felt in awe of them often, that they had the kind of experiences that they were having. I write about a kid who became a chess champion. I write about a girl who was in the slow class in sixth grade, homeless for a lot as a child, and is now entering her sophomore year in college, kids who are succeeding way beyond what their circumstances would have suggested. And so on the one hand, I feel just kind of in awe of them, but I also feel like there's something, I don't want to just say, these are these kind of magical, resilient kids who somehow succeeded despite the odds, because I feel like it's really clear that for all of these kids, they had some help. And right now, the kind of help that I think the kids who grew up in those circumstances get is pretty random and haphazard, and they got lucky. They had an adult somewhere in their lives, whether it was a family member or a teacher or a coach or a chess coach, who was able to sort of take them by the hand and help them come up with strategies to overcome the sort of adversity that they had experienced early in life. And right now we don't have a system of helping kids in any kind of organized way who have those sorts of experiences. So it made me feel both a deep sense of possibility for what can happen to kids who right now, you know, we're mostly writing off, who are ending up in really, you know, very bad circumstances. And also a sense of responsibility, a real sense that, like, this is not some kind of magical process where, like, maybe some kids will do okay, or that it's someone else's business. It really was this feeling that, like, we can systematize this. We can create a system for kids who are growing up in deep adversity and help them succeed in ways that right now seem almost impossible.
It seems like such an apt conversation given the political discussion going on about whether you did this yourself and who helped whom, you know. And you, because you talk about the conversation of how to best combat poverty, for example, is kind of faded into silence right now. So how is this going to play out in the current political landscape?
It's a good question. I feel like right now these kids on the South Side are not part of the national political conversation, and I feel like they should be, and they have been at other points in our recent history. And I wrote an article in the Times Magazine last month about the fact that, you know, this neighborhood where some of these kids are growing up in on the South Side of Chicago is the neighborhood where President Obama, when he was in his late 20s, was working. And so he's somebody who is really steeped in a lot of this this research, these ideas, and certainly the lives of these kids. And so, you know, I think in when you're in a time of economic uncertainty like we are in this country right now, it is hard to get voters or citizens organized around the idea of helping someone else, because everyone feels like, well, we're disadvantaged, so we don't want to give money and give support to other people who might be more disadvantaged than we are. But I feel like, at the same time, I feel like Americans are really a very generous people, and that if we're able to frame this discussion in a way that is about, you know, the whole country getting better, and not about handouts, but about helping kids, giving kids opportunities to succeed, I think we can really move to some solutions.
Paul Tough, his book is called How Children Succeed: Grit, Curiosity, and the Hidden Power of Character. Paul, thanks very much for the time.
Thank you so much.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.